Threaten from the nature of philosophical inquiry. Characterization of philosophy. One reasonably good, beginning characterization of philosophy, is that philosophy is the sustained inquiry into the principles and presuppositions of any field of inquiry. As such, philosophy is not a subject of study, like other subjects of study. Any given field of inquiry has philosophical roots and extensions. From the philosophy of restaurant management, to philosophy of physics, philosophy can be characterized as an attitude, an approach, or perhaps even a calling, to ask answer, or even just comment, upon certain kinds of questions. These questions involve the nature, scope, and boundaries of that field of interest. In general then, philosophy is both an activity involving thinking about these kinds of ultimate questions, and an activity involving the construction of sound reasons, or insights into our most basic assumptions about the universe and our lives. Quite often, simply asking a series of why questions can reveal these basic presuppositions. Children often ask such questions, sometimes to the annoyance of their parents, in order to get a feel for the way the world works. They're asking an exhaustive sequence of why questions can reveal principles upon which life is based. As a first example, let us imagine the following dialogue between two persons as to why one of them is reading this philosophy book. Samantha's playing devil's advocate. Samantha, why are you reading Redden for philosophical inquiry? Stephen, it's an assigned book in philosophy, one of my college courses. Samantha, why take philosophy? Stephen, well, philosophy fulfills the humanities elective. Samantha, why do you want to fulfill that elective? At this point in the dialogue, a growing resemblance to the insatiable curiosity of some children is beginning to be unmistakable. We continue with the cross-examination. Stephen, I have to fulfill the humanities elective in order to graduate. Samantha, why do you want to graduate? Stephen, what? Well, I'd like to get a decent job, which pays a decent salary. Samantha, well, why then, do you want a good job, making money? Undoubtedly at this point, the conversation seems artificial, because for some persons, the goal of graduating college is about as far as they have thought their life, through if, indeed they have thought that far, and so for such persons, this is where the questioning would have normally stopped. Other persons, however, can see beyond college to more basic ends, such as Stephen's want of an interesting vocation with sufficient recompense, among other things. Even so, we have not yet arrived at the kind of basic presuppositions we have been talking about for Stephen's life, so we continue with Samantha's questioning. Stephen, what do you mean? A good job, which pays well, will enable me the resources to have an enjoyable life, where I can do some of the important things I want to do. Samantha, why do you want a life like that? Stephen, huh? Are you serious? When questions seem to make no sense, very often, we have reached one of those ultimate fundamental unquestioned assumptions. In this case, a basic principle by which Stephen lives his life seems to be based on seeking happiness. So in a sense, although he might not be aware of it at the moment, he believes he is working toward this goal by reading this textbook. Of course, his choice of a means to obtain that end of happiness could be mistaken or perhaps even chosen in ignorance, in which case he might not be able to obtain what he wants out of life. If the thought occurs to you that it is sometimes the case that we might not be mistaken about our choices, and indeed might be actually choosing knowledgeably, and even so, we might not achieve what he desire, then you are already doing philosophy. If we assume that Samantha is genuinely asking questions here and has no ulterior motive, then it is evident that her questions relate to a basic presupposition upon which Stephen is basing his life. Perhaps she thinks the quest for a well-paying job is mistaken or is insufficient for an excellent life. Indirectly, she might be assuming that other fundamental values are more important. If the questioning were to continue between Samantha and Stephen, it quite possibly could continue along the lines of attempting to uncover some of these additional presuppositions upon which a life of excellence can be based. In philosophy, these kinds of questions are often concerned with assumptions, presuppositions, postulates, or definitions upon which a field of inquiry is based, and these questions can be concerned with the meaning, significance, or integration of the results discovered or proposed by a field of inquiry. For example, the answer gravity is often thought to be a meaningful answer to the question, why do objects fall in the direction toward the center of the Earth? But for this answer to be meaningful, we would have to know what gravity is. If one were to answer a kind of force or an attraction between two objects, then the paraphrase gives no insight into the nature of what gravity is, for the paraphrase is viciously circular. Many scientists hold the view that if we know the rules, we consider that we understand the world. The rules for gravity are: every object in the universe attracts every other object with a force which for any two bodies is proportional to the mass of each and varies inversely as the square of the distance between them. An object responds to a force by accelerating in the direction of the force by an amount that is inversely proportional to the mass of the object. Yet, there must be more to understanding gravity than this. Consider a mentalist who stands before a door and concentrates deeply. Suppose the door opens, and no one, neither scientist nor magician, is able to see how the mentalist accomplishes the opening of the door. So we ask, how did you do that? The mentalist responds, smavity. We reply, what is smavity? The mentalist says, smavity is a force and attraction between me and the door. The scientist on the scene observes and measures. The mentalist attracts the door with a force which between them is proportional to the mass of each and varies inversely as the square of the distance between them. And the door responds to the mentalist by accelerating in the direction of the force by an amount that is inversely proportional to the mass of the door. From a philosophical point of view, even though we know the rules, we do not understand the phenomenon. Philosophy also involves new assumptions or presuppositions as reasons for the explanation of natural phenomena. New assumptions, for example, the questioning of the fifth postulate of Euclid, which led to the development of non-Euclidean geometries, or the questioning of Aristotle's assumption that heavier bodies fall faster than lighter bodies of similar shape, which led to more modern theories of gravitation, are kinds of philosophical inquiry which can help to establish new fields of knowledge. What's more, the application and reinterpretations of the results and discoveries of the resulting different fields of inquiry properly belong to the domain of philosophy as well, even though, in many instances, the investigators themselves might have had no formal philosophic training. Since philosophical questioning covers so much territory, some people characterize a philosophical problem as any question that does not have a well-established method of solution, but that definition is undoubtedly too broad. Perhaps the point can be clarified by the following excerpt from the legendary story of the barometer physics problem. This oft-quoted account illustrates great ingenuity and creative problem-solving. Ultimately, however, the description catalogs admittedly standard, though clever, methods of thinking. Philosophical thinking begins when we are frustratingly confused as to how to proceed to answer a question, and after conceptual reframing, philosophy can end with the kinds of solutions summarized here by a physics professor at the University of Washington St. Louis. The Barometer Story by Alexander Calandra. Some time ago, I received a call from a colleague who asked if I would be the referee on the grading of an examination question. He was about to give a student a 0 for his answer to a physics question, while the student claimed he should receive a perfect score and would if the system were not set up against the student. The instructor and the student agreed to submit this to an impartial arbiter, and I was selected. I went to my colleague's office and read the examination question, show how it is possible to determine the height of a tall building with the aid of a barometer. The student had answered, take a barometer to the top of the building, attach a long rope to it, lower the barometer to the street, and then bring it up, measuring the length of the rope. The length of the rope is the height of the building. I pointed out that the student really had a strong case for full credit, since he had answered the question completely and correctly. On the other hand, if full credit was given, it could well contribute a high grade for the student in his physics course. The high grade is supposed to certify competence in physics, but the answer did not confirm this. I suggested that the student have another try at answering the question. I was not surprised that my colleague agreed, but I was surprised that the student did. I gave the student 6 minutes to answer the question, with a warning that the answer should show some knowledge of physics. At the end of 5 minutes, he had not written anything. I asked if he wished to give up, but he said no. He had many answers to this problem, he was just thinking of the best one. I excused myself for interrupting him and asked him to please go on. In the next minute, he dashed off his answer, with red tape the barometer, to the top of the building, and lean over the edge of the roof. Drop that barometer, timing its fall with a stopwatch. Then using the formula S equal it, calculate the height of the building. At this point I asked my colleague if he would give up. He conceded, and I gave the student almost full credit. In leaving my colleague's office, I recalled that the student had said he had many other answers to the problem, so I asked him what they were. Oh yes, said the student. There are a great many ways of getting the height of a tall building with a barometer. For example, you could take the barometer out on a sunny day and measure the height of the barometer and the length of its shadow and the length of the shadow of the building, and by the use of a simple proportion determine the height of the building. Fine, I asked. And the others? Yes, said the student. There is a very basic measurement method that you will like. In this method you take the barometer and begin to walk up the stairs. As you climb the stairs, you mark off the length of the barometer along the wall. You then count the number of marks, and this will give you the height of the building in barometer units. A very direct method. Of course, if you want a more sophisticated method, you can tie the barometer to the end of a string, swing it as a pendulum, and determine the value of G at the street level and at the top of the building. From the difference of the two values of G, the height of the building can be calculated. Finally, he concluded, there are many other ways of solving the problem. Probably the best, he said, is to take the barometer to the basement and knock on the superintendent's door. When the superintendent answers, you speak to him as follows: Mr. Superintendent, here I have a fine barometer. If you tell me the height of this building, I will give you this barometer. At this point I asked the student if he really did know the conventional answer to this question. He admitted that he did, said that he was fed up with high school and college instructors trying to teach him how to think using the scientific method. Main divisions of philosophy. It may well be wondered at this point as to the exact difference between philosophy and the sciences. The following excerpt from the entry Philosophy in the authoritative 1911 Encyclopaedia Britannica explains one aspect of this relation well, and is well worth reading carefully. In distinguishing philosophy from the sciences, it may not be amiss at the outset to guard against the possible misunderstanding that philosophy is concerned with a subject matter different from, and in some obscure way transcending, the subject matter of the sciences. Now that psychology, or the observational and experimental study of mind, may be said to have been definitively included among the positive sciences, there is not even the apparent ground which once existed for such an idea. Philosophy, even under its most discredited name of metaphysics, has no other subject matter than the nature of the real world, as that world lies around us in everyday life, and lies open to observers in every side. But if this is so, it may be asked, what function can remain for philosophy when a very portion of the field is already lotted out and enclosed by specialists? Philosophy claims to be the science of the whole, but if we get the knowledge of the parts from the different sciences, what is there left for philosophy to tell us? To this it is sufficient to answer generally that the synthesis of the parts is something more than that detailed knowledge of the parts in separation which is gained by the man of science. It is with ultimate synthesis that philosophy concerns itself. It has to show that the subject matter which we are all dealing with in detail really is a whole, consisting of articulated members. Evidently, therefore, the relation existing between and the sciences will be, to some extent, one of reciprocal influence. The author of the century is pointing to the unifying and systematizing methods of philosophy for other disciplines. The coherence of the whole is made possible by consistent fundamental principles. The article continues, "The sciences may be said to furnish philosophy with its matter, but philosophical criticism reacts upon the matter thus furnished and transforms it. Such transformation is inevitable, for the parts only exist and can only be fully, i.e. truly, known in their relation to the whole. A pure specialist, if such a being were possible, would be merely an instrument whose results had to be coordinated and used by others. Now though a pure specialist may be an abstraction of the mind, the tendency of specialists in any department naturally is to lose sight of the whole in attention to the particular categories or modes of nature's working which happen to be exemplified and fruitfully applied in their own sphere of investigation, and in proportion as this is the case it becomes necessary for their theories to be coordinated with the results of other inquirers and set, as it were, in the light of the whole. This task of coordination, in the broadest sense, is undertaken by philosophy, for the philosopher is essentially what Plato, in A Happy Moment, styled him, /SGR, /NGR, /PGR, /TGR, /KGR, /SGR, the man who takes a synoptic or comprehensive view of the universe as a whole. The aim of philosophy, whether fully attainable or not, is to exhibit the universe as a rational system and the harmony of all its parts, and accordingly the philosopher refuses to consider the parts out of their relation to the whole, whose parts they are. Philosophy corrects in this way the abstractions which are inevitably made by the scientific specialist, and may claim therefore to be the only concrete science, that is to say, the only science which takes account of all the elements in the problem, and the only science whose results can claim to be true in more than a provisional sense. The foundational and unifying aspects of philosophy form the characteristics of our beginning study of philosophical inquiry in this introductory set of readings. It is important to point out, however, that these characteristics are not the be-all and end-all of philosophy. Epistemology, the study of knowledge. Traditionally, philosophical questions have been grouped into three areas, which we will very briefly describe and suggest a few examples. Given the nature of philosophical inquiry, these areas are interdependent. Undoubtedly, it will occur to you that each example provided below has characteristics related to other areas of philosophy, and indeed philosophical problems are rarely limited to just one area of the discipline. Epistemology, theory of knowledge. The inquiry into what knowledge is, what can be known, and what lies beyond our understanding. The investigation into the origin, structure, methods, and validity of justification and knowledge. The study of the interrelation of reason, truth, and experience. As an example of an epistemological problem, consider the lottery paradox, an argument occasionally used to support skepticism. The doctrine that genuine knowledge is impossible. Some persons believe nothing in this life can be certain, anything is possible, and nothing is for sure. Even if we do not accept radical skepticism, supposedly the best that we can do as human beings is to justify our beliefs in terms of their probability. On this view, we could be justified in believing something is true if it is highly probable, but we would not be justified in believing something is true if it has a very low probability of being true. Admittedly, this kind of justification is not certainty or knowledge. Let's examine these assumptions more carefully. Suppose we, with thousands of other persons, enter a fair ticket lottery. Since the probability of our winning the lottery is quite low, on the above assumption, we would be fully justified in believing that we will not win. What's more, since all ticket holders have the same chance as we do to win, on the same assumption, we would be fully justified in believing that each one of those individuals will not win either. Thus we are justified in concluding that no ticket will win, since the probability of any one ticket winning is quite low. Of course, at the same time, we know that this reasonable belief is mistaken because we know that, in a fair lottery, one ticket will win. The lottery paradox indicates beyond doubt that knowledge cannot result directly from empirical inquiry, since any belief could only involve probable conclusions, which are fallible. Another perplexing example from epistemology is Bertrand Russell's 5-minute world hypothesis. Suppose the universe were suddenly created, 5 minutes ago, complete with memories, historical and geological records, and so forth. That is, at the moment of creation, the universe would have all the evidence that it was billions of years old already, packed in. How could it ever be known that the creation of the universe did not occur 5 minutes ago? The hypothesis initially seems implausible, yet how can we know that the universe wasn't created a few minutes ago? Certainly the 5-minute world hypothesis is inconsistent with many of our other beliefs. If it were true, we would have to give up these other beliefs if we were to hold it, but how could we prove what is the case beyond any shadow of doubt? From a purely empirical point of view, no evidence is available which could prove that God isn't constantly creating the universe moment by moment. In fact, as we will see in part 3 of this text, some persons who believe in predestination eschew the notion of causality and believe God actually does create the universe moment by moment. Many times in philosophy, proposed solutions to specifically formulated problems such as these lead to amazing shifts in perspective by which the nature of the universe can be comprehended. Metaphysics ontology, the study of reality. Metaphysics or ontology, theory of reality. The inquiry into what is real, as opposed to what is appearance, either conceived as that which the methods of science presuppose, or that with which the methods of science are concerned. The inquiry into the first principles of nature, the study of the most fundamental generalizations as to what exists. A typical example of an ontological problem is the well-known difficulty of finding a criterion of individuation for distinguishing things. Suppose we are asked to sort potatoes into two baskets, one for the large ones and one for small ones. For the most part, we wouldn't expect many problems with such a straightforward task. Very large potatoes would be placed in the basket selected for the large potatoes, and tiny potatoes would be placed in the basket selected for the small potatoes. But of course, there is a problem. What shall we do about the potatoes, which are difficult to judge? For example, a potato sized somewhere between the large and small ones, e.g. one that is short and wide, one that is long and thin, or one that is just plain medium-sized. We could set up a criterion of potato-ness by means of a precise or an operational definition which clearly distinguishes between large and small, perhaps by measuring volume, weight, or length in order to mark accurately the difference. But then would such a criterion thereby entail that a medium potato does not exist? If we admit existence of medium potatoes, then our criterion of potato-ness must be revised to take account of the newly discovered entity of the medium potato. However, as you may have already guessed, our problems have now doubled. We now need criteria to distinguish the large from the medium and the medium from the small. Ontologically, a new problem arises. Should we admit the existence of medium-large and medium-small potatoes? If so, lamentably, our problem again propagates itself again in the same manner. Do you think that the kinds of things that exist in the universe are independent of the concepts we use to describe them? Or do our concepts determine the kinds of things we can know to exist? Do the mere actions of perceiving and thinking limit the content of our ideas? What could be the reality beyond our ideas? Axiology, the study of value. Axiology, theory of value. The inquiry into the nature, criteria, and metaphysical status of value. Axiology, in turn, is divided into two main parts, ethics and aesthetics. Although the term axiology is not widely used outside of philosophy, the problems of axiology include 1. How values are experienced, 2. The kinds of value, 3. The standards of value, and 4. and what sense values can be said to exist. Axiology then is the subject area which tries to answer problems like these. 1. How are values related to interest, desire, will, experience, and means to end? 2. How do different kinds of value interrelate? 3. Can the distinction between intrinsic and instrumental values be maintained? 4. Are values ultimately rationally or objectively based? 5. What is the difference between a matter of fact and a matter of value? There are two main subdivisions of axiology, ethics and aesthetics. Ethics involves the theoretical study of the moral valuation of human action. It's not just concerned with the study of principles of conduct. Aesthetics involves the conceptual problems associated with describing the relationships among our feelings and senses with respect to the experience of art and nature. Each of these subdivisions are briefly characterized below. Aesthetics, the inquiry into feelings, judgments, or standards concerning the nature of beauty, and related concepts such as the tragic, the sublime, or the moving, especially in the arts, the analysis of the values of sensory experience, and the associated feelings, or attitudes in art and nature, the theories developed in Les Beaux-Arts. Gustav Fechner, an early psychologist, asked 228 men and 119 women which of the following rectangles is aesthetically the most pleasing. Take a look at the following figures. Which figure would you choose? Fechner's experiment has been repeated with variations in methodology many times, and occasionally his results have been supported. In general, the rectangle with a ratio of 21:34 was preferred, with the rectangles adjacent to this one and the picture being rated highly also. The ratio of 21:34 is the so-called golden rectangle because it's based on the golden ratio, or divine proportion. It's rectangle D above. Euclid defines the golden proportion as: a straight line is said to have been cut in extreme and mean ratio, when as the whole line is to the greater segment, so is the greater to the lesser. Notice in the accompanying figure of the golden section and accompanying examples how that the reciprocal of this ratio involves the same sequence of digits. This ratio is the golden ratio and is ubiquitous in art and nature. Investigators have discovered the golden proportion as the foundational spatial relation in Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa, Salvador Dali's Sacrament of the Last Supper, and numerous other paintings. This number appears in plant and animal growth and has intriguing relationships with architecture and sculpture. The golden section is directly connected with the Fibonacci numbers and the basis of the spiral. Would it be reasonable to conclude then that beauty is merely a mathematical relationship? Or is it more likely that the ubiquitous occurrence of the golden section is just a result of some prosaic numerology and is an example of our ability to manufacture what we want to find by manipulating innumerable numerical relationships, which we also create? Moreover, how would these mathematical observations be related to the widespread belief that truly remarkable artists are those who break the rules or laws of past art? Ethics, the inquiry into the nature and concepts of morality, including the important problems of good, right, duty, virtue, and choice, the study of the principles of living well and doing well as a human being, the moral principles implicit in mores, religion, or philosophy. As a philosophical problem in ethics, consider this example analyzed by J.O. Ermson in his well-known essay, Saints and Heroes. We may imagine a squad of soldiers to be practicing the throwing of live hand grenades. A grenade slips from the hand of one of them and rolls on the ground near the squad. One of them sacrifices his life by throwing himself on the grenade and protecting his comrades with his own body. It is quite unreasonable to suppose that such a man must be impelled by the sort of emotion that he might be impelled by if his best friend were in the squad. Did the soldier who threw himself on the grenade do the right thing? If he did not cover the grenade, probably several soldiers would be killed. His action undoubtedly saved lives. Certainly, an action which saves lives is a morally correct action. One might even be inclined to conclude that saving lives is a duty. But if this were so, Wouldn't each of the soldiers have a moral obligation or duty to save his comrades? Surely this cannot be a correct assessment of the situation, because if it were morally obligatory for each one of them to fall on the grenade, each should then have to fight off the others in order to perform his moral obligation to get to the grenade first. What would you conclude about this example? Would it be our duty to save lives in this situation, ceteris paribus, or would we be going beyond the call of duty in such a case? Does our right to self-preservation supersede our obligation to save the lives of other persons? Would the number of lives involved in the instance make an ethical difference? What if such an action were to save the world from nuclear destruction? Admittedly, these brief descriptions and examples do not adequately reflect the nature of philosophy, and they are not especially typical problems. Even so, they are problems intellectually grasped, without attendant dangers of confusion by emotional prejudice, and they involve the same sorts of issues as more socially controversial philosophical problems, which often involve a plethora of side issues and persuasive definitions such as euthanasia, genocide, capital punishment, and abortion. This completes the reading of the nature of philosophical inquiry under the new free documentation license. This file in this and other formats is available on the internet at philosophy.lander.edu.